find you can read that poem with perfect satisfaction and pleasure by yourself, having as much meaning as you find it necessary to have. If the experience is complete in that way, then ignore the secondary criticism. However, if you find in a poem, and you will find it now, increasingly in these poems, that you hit something which is totally inscrutable to you, so that you cannot, with an aid of reading, get any comprehensive sense of the poem at all, a point that it is driving at, the reason why it was thought worth writing, or the reason why it was thought worth writing in such and such a style, then is the time to pause and apply yourself to some secondary criticism. And Paul's Prolegomena is, in its compendious manual fashion, the one where you probably would go first. I will, however, give you two other books of criticism which would help. Again, they're books, sections of books, not whole books. I do this because, as you will readily have discovered, if you've gone into the stacks at all and looked up and down the shelf upon shelf, the scholarly industry, which has been expended upon W.B. Yeats for now 30 years or longer, is in fact self-defeating. There are now so many books, not to speak of articles and periodicals, which you can think of, that you don't know where to start. So let it be said, in case anybody's got any illusions about it, that I certainly haven't read all the books on those shelves. I'll give you the ones, some that I have read. First, there is this book to which I contributed a chapter myself. It's called An Honoured Guest. It's edited by Donoghue and Milne-Ryan. I'll write that down. This is one of several volumes which came out to honour the centenary of Yeats's birth. And I think this is really very good, not because I happen to be in it myself. It was a sensible undertaking. The editors asked one critic to take some one collection and give an account of it in a brief chapter. In fact, largely omitting, as far as that goes, the earliest collections. So we have, for instance, The Green Helmet and Responsibilities, the last two collections that we've been looking at, an essay on them by T.R. Henn, the man who wrote The Lonely Tower, and whom I've referred to several times. And then we have an essay on this collection, The Wild Swans at Coole, by Graham Martin. And so that's what I'll write up on the board. This is an account of the collection as a whole, including, of course, poems which were in the collection and are in the collected poems that have been left out of your collection. Graham Martin in, and this is the title, An Honoured Guest. Edited by, and these are the names you want, look it up in the card index, D. Donoghue. And Milne-Ryan? J.R. Milne-Ryan. You'll find it either under Donoghue or Milne-Ryan. Think I had that put on this reserve, did I? I haven't seen it. Think I did, but I can't be sure. And then for some of the poems in here, particularly the second of them, the long poem in memory of Major Robert Gregory, one of his most important poems. Major Robert Gregory, you remember, Lady Gregory's son, who was shot down in his airplane over the Italian front and killed. For this, there's a very good discussion of this in one of the more important works of criticism over the last 20 years by the Englishman Frank Kermode, now professor at Cambridge, in a book called Romantic Image. A slim book, the weight is, in fact, worth reading as a whole. Well, the particular discussion of that particular poem is what I remember particularly from it and what will be particularly valuable. Nonetheless, anybody who can can find the time to read Kermode through will find it also well worth it. All right, I'll do something about that. Though I'm going to have to ask somebody to do it for me, because I'm taking an aeroplane soon after lunch. Mr. Sherman, could you handle this for us?
Yeah. What do I have to do?
Well, you just find these books on the stacks, and then. Now, why don't you go to Mrs. White, the coloured lady who looks after reserve and also periodicals in the periodical room. Explain that, could you add these onto her list and have her put on reserve?
Mrs. White?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, she's always there, but if she isn't there, they've got a sheet with a list already, and you just want to add these three titles. Thank you very much. An Irish airman foresees his death. I mentioned it also about Gregory. We want here to have. Well, this I think I could supply in first discussion when we meet again. These poems, and particularly the elegy in memory of Major Robert Gregory, we need. Full apprehension of it, a different sort of information from any that we have mostly been concerned with so far. Not only do we need graphical knowledge about who Gregory was, what Yeats's attitude to him is, the place that sort of Irishman and Yeats's sort of Irishman play in the history of Ireland and of England, all of which we have been chiefly concerned with lately, but also a profound change, well, we've seen this happening. A profound change coming over Yeats's style. We've seen this happening. We've talked about how, under the pressure of the Maud Gonne connection, involved as that is with Yeats's growing disillusion with the possibilities of Irish culture under Irish independence, how this forced him necessarily away from his early affiliations with the English Romantics, with Shelley, with Morris, and forced him really back into earlier centuries, into reading with renewed attention and admiration poets of the 17th century and the 16th, like John Donne, like Philip Sidney, and in the 19th century, a sort of oddball Victorian like Walter Savage Landor. And this is now become steadily more marked, and is one of the things that is most remarkable about this phase of Yeats's career. Increasingly, and this long elegy in memory of Major Robert Gregory is very much a case in point, the models that Yeats is using are by this time hardly at all 19th century romantic models, almost entirely 16th and 17th century ones. Ben Jonson, John Donne, Abram Cowley, and Philip Sidney, Edmund Spenser. These are the names which now we need to remember. And those of you who have taken some Renaissance courses, here or elsewhere, ought to be on the lookout for the deliberate use of Renaissance conventions, Renaissance diction, Renaissance stanza forms, even. In this poem and in others that we now embark upon. Kermode's discussion brings some of that out. There's then a series of love poems of a very, as I find, a very charming sort. Solomon to Sheba and to a young beauty. which the important thing to note is that these are no longer to Lord Lawn, but are in fact to Yeats's young wife. He, with a sort of a comical, tender irony, speaks of himself as Solomon, a wise old man, and she as the Queen of Sheba. And in fact, you'll see several poems crop up, and this is fairly standard. The Sheba is Mrs. Yeats. And I don't think these are difficult poems at all. They are surprisingly, and I think charmingly, erotic poems. I mean, they're not about... They're distinctly not like the love poems that he wrote to Morgan, which is all at a level of higher platonic abstraction and idealism. They are distinctly poems, certainly not of lust rather than of love, no, but poems which are full of the ecstasy or satisfaction of physical love. The one to a young beauty, which is on page 57-58, ends with a significant couplet in relation to what I've just been saying and what I was saying before. The last stanza is, I know what wages beauty gives, how hard a life her servant lives, yet praise the winter's god. There's not a fool can call me friend, and I may dine at journey's end with Landor and with Dunn. Picking up of those two names is highly significant, as it's meant to be. Both of them names which 10 years before had virtually no significance for Yeats at all. On woman, may God be praised for woman that gives up all her mind. A man may find in no man a friendship of her kind. Is again addressed to Mrs. Yeats, as we see in the last two beautiful lines, and live like Solomon, that Sheba led her dance. And then at the end of I'm passing over several poems which are in fact of great beauty and which we spent some time on, for instance, the sequence Upon a Dying Lady. And then we come at the end of this selection, and this is the other thing that we must bear in mind for the reading we now embark upon, a series of poems. They have titles like Ego Dominus Tuus and The Phases of the Moon, The Cat and the Moon, The Saint and the Hunchback, Two Songs of a Fool, The Double Vision of Michael Robartes. These are on pages 69 through to 81, and they conclude in this selection, as they do in the selected poems, the representation of this particular collection of the Wild Swans at Court. These are the poems which, for the first time, elaborate a symbolic and mystical system which Yeats worked out with the help of his young wife it took him a long time, and there are some gradual additions to the account of it, but which originally arose out of mediumistic communications through the young Mrs. Yeats, which began soon after she married W.B. Very soon after. On the afternoon of October 24th, 1917, 4 days after my marriage, my wife surprised me by attempting automatic writing. What came in disjointed sentences, in almost illegible writing, was so exciting, sometimes so profound, that I persuaded her to give an hour or so day after day to the unknown writer, and after some half dozen such hours, offered to spend what remained of life explaining and piecing together these scattered sentences. This is what he explained through his wife as medium to the spirits who were dictating these messages to him. No, was the answer. We have come to give you metaphors for poetry. Which is very, very significant indeed. If this was a body of arcane wisdom and religious revelation, in fact, then Yeats says, I will throw away my poetry, I will spend all the rest of my time writing an explanation of this system which you are dictating. To which they reply, no, we have come to give you metaphors for poetry. which again, you see, is one of Yeats's very careful, oblique ways of, in fact, detaching himself from the body of magical, symbolical, philosophical discourse. So that it becomes possible for him to say, I think what he means to say in a passage like that, I needed a system, I haven't got one. If I were a Christian, I would have one. If I were a pagan poet, I would have one. I haven't got one. I don't find the need of one in daily life, but I find the need of it for poetry. Therefore, I construct this whole mythological system as a sort of scaffolding in order that I can go on writing poems. And this means that the poems which do depend upon this body of knowledge are a distinct and, in many ways, very troublesome part of Yeats's writing. Yeats and his wife went on with this extraordinary experiment for many years, 7 years in fact, and Yeats recorded the results in 1925, in the first place, in this book, Vision. Even after that, he went on adding to it, refining it, completing it. And this edition, which is a Collier paperback, and of which some copies were in the bookstore at the beginning of the semester, I gather they were snapped up by some of you, this brings together the several versions of this symbolical system, which we call a vision. Now, those of you who have this book, it is the beginning of the semester, this is the time when you can begin to use it in relation to these poems that I just specified at the end of Faces of the Moon. Those who didn't buy it will have to have access to it in on the reserve, where I did put it. If you're going to understand these late poems at all, I want to make this quite plain. There is a certain sort of study of Yeats which is undertaken by people with a certain temperament, to whom this relationship, the symbolical mythological system, and the poems which derive from it, are quite central. I am not of that temperament myself, and it is not the approach that I have taken. As you know, I'm more interested in the political, historical, biographical context for Yeats, rather than this context, which is a curiously timeless and metaphysical one. And hence, for a reader like myself, I'm being quite frank, or trying to be, this body of material in Yeats is rather a nuisance, quite honestly. And some of you will find it so also. Others of you, I'm sure, will leap at it with cries of glee. I mean, you know, people come in different shapes, that's all. But in any event, we can't avoid it at this point. So we have to do something with it. I'm trying to say that I would be quite indulgent, for personal reasons, towards those who find that this particular body of poetry is irritating and who go easy on it. However, this is it. Here is a vision, and all of us, let me be quite clear to say that all of us must read the vision, or read in it, to get the general notion of this symbolic system. In fact, no, let me be more specific. Even if you are skeptical and easily irritated by this, you have, let us say, a low tedium quotient for this sort of writing. Still, you need to read this book. Some of us will read it fast, some of us will read it very slowly. But we need to do it. And so that too is a part of the reading list which I'm now asking for
to be done, if possible, this week before Friday, but almost certainly not, at any rate by next Monday.
It's not a big book. And also, there are, it's a very curious and fascinating book. Oh, let's face it. I want to say more about this, though I know that we're going to talk about autobiographies in a minute. But I think there's much to be said about the whole notion of a poet in mid-career sitting down to make up a private religion or mythology for himself, because that's what it amounts to. Yeats is not alone in finding the necessity for this. To give another example from British poetry, one of his younger contemporaries, Robert Graves, still alive, similarly, at middle year, the middle years had to, found it necessary to do a big book, which some of you will have read, fascinating, not unreliable, called The Dark Goddess. He's now invented a black goddess as well. But yes, that's right. The White Goddess. Again, in order that Graves could write poems out of them. I think Graves himself might perfectly willingly accept that formula. I have done it to give myself metaphors for poetry. Of course, this is just one example out of many. If you extend the terms, our understanding of the sense of symbolic mythology, it would be possible to argue that every ambitious poet of our time in the English-speaking countries has found it necessary at a certain point to stop and to do this. Every ambitious poet. Because you can go on quite a long way, of course, with the sort of very beautiful and important poems that we've seen Yeats producing. Poems which, in the widest sense, are occasional. Occasioned by public events, personal relations, and so on. But if you have achieved a certain success and a certain number of degree of well-earned fame by building up a body of work of this sort, then you begin to set your sights really high, to think, why shouldn't I be like Milton? Why shouldn't I be like Shakespeare, like Dante? Why shouldn't I, at any rate, aim at that? And then, almost inevitably, you realize why you can't is because you're an agnostic, skeptical 20th century character and you do not have a body of belief. Whether the Christian belief, elaborately systematized, that Dante had, or the elaborate and learned understanding of English medieval history, which created a patriotic mythology for Shakespeare through the history cycle, or the quite different sort of Christianity come politics which John Milton, or, well, one could go on, the Enlightenment itself produces what we can in the fullest sense call a working mythology for poets so different as Alexander Pope, Samuel Johnson, and even Shelley. In short, we all know that if we know anything about the past poetry in our language at all, I mean, this side of the Atlantic, the same thing crops up with Emerson. Emerson has to create a philosophy in order to write poems out of it, and in order that Walt Whitman should write poems out of it after him. The necessity for a large work of attempts to be comprehensive and epic, a work which attempts to give something like a total account of what human experience in history is like, needs to have a structure of serious or half-serious belief in terms of which to operate. And hence, it is entirely normal and understandable that Yeats embarks upon this at this point. A very interesting case here is that of that one of his English predecessors, which from the very beginning had mattered most to him and who continues to matter in a sense more than anyone else, despite the changing allegiances to Donne rather than Shelley.
And this is, of course, the name of William Blake.
Those of you who have studied any Blake at all will see that the pattern I've just been
talking about in a poet's life is remarkably clear in Blake's life. After only two collections of lyrics, Songs of Innocence and Songs of Experience, those indeed then put together and already have in embryo are fantastically original and, as it got elaborated, extraordinarily elaborate private religion which Blake made up through one prophetic book after another. 28, therefore, was undoubtedly aware of this in the career of this poet whom he greatly admired, and so there is that reason why Yeats embarked upon this venture at this point. The point that I want to make, however, is figured upon the word symbol and symbolic, to which we must add another word, symbolist. This is a large topic, and I'm only going to take a first very casual bite at it right now. Blake uses symbols, and Blake writes a little poem called The Sick Rose. He's not talking about, in the first instance, about a real flower that was red or white, which he had seen going outside his window. It is symbolizing something. And when he says that the rose has been invaded by a worm that flies in the night, we are not supposed to turn to entomology and to discover what sort of worm it is. The worm and the rose are symbolic, quite plainly. It's symbolic poetry. And we have seen the same in Yeats's Rose, the rose all the time, which is a real rose, except in a very, very marginal way indeed. So that they are poems who use symbols. Now, as we know, and as was mentioned earlier on, they had been preceded by several, not Blake, but Yeats had been preceded by several generations of French poetry, French poets who themselves had declared themselves symbolist, or, in French of course, symboliste poets. Poets like Baudelaire, Mallarmé, Valéry, Verlaine, and, more dubiously, Rimbaud, Corbière, Laforgue. Now, is the symbol then, as used by these French poets, in their poets, the same as what we mean by symbol, as we have just briefly described the way it works in Blake? The answer is firmly no. And a great deal of people get it wrong about this, including, I may say, Ezra Pound, at least at one point. They can see that Yeats is a symbol-mongering poet, a poet who uses symbols, a poet who, to push it a bit further, is not in the first place interested in the world of phenomena, in themselves or for themselves, but is interested only in breaking through that, reading it like a code. So he is, in that sense, a profoundly symbolic poet, but then Pound originally, and other sense have said, in other words, he's a symbolist poet. No, that is the step that we must not take. And I do suggest to you that in order to keep this quite plain in one's head, if you ever get into this area, you use the word symbolist always with its French E on the end, symboliste, so as to remind you that he's a symbolical poet, but he is not a symbolist poet. This becomes really quite important. This is the point. Yeats himself, quite plainly, as you, those of you who have read the early essays in Ideas of Good and Evil will realize, Yeats himself was muddled about this in his youth. His early enthusiasm for Blake was for the use of symbols. He learned through Arthur Simons, about the turn of the century, about symbol-making, symbol-using poets in France. With Simons's help, he was able to read some of those poets. Well, not me. And he, in Ideas of Good and Evil, he talks as if the symbol in Mallarmé and the symbol in Blake are the same things with the same functions. In fact, they're not. They're profoundly not. In that, well, very briefly, in a French symbolist poem, notes the symbol does not have a fixed meaning. There is no systematic philosophy to which the poems can be referred. That each poem conveys, constructs, in its own terms and for as long as it endures, a symbolic meaning for, let us say, a swan. But the next poem will use a swan in quite a different way. There is no fixed system, no code in that sense to be broken behind a French Chambrist poem. My example of the swan is not a random one, and indeed I'm now talking to those of you whose French is pretty good, like, and who have perhaps come to us comparative lit. There is a whole hierarchy of swan poems in modern poetry, which begins in France and comes into England and Ireland. And there's the Mallarmé. No, first of all, it's not Mallarmé, but Baudelaire. One of Baudelaire's very greatest poems, Baudelaire, Le Cygne. Mallarmé, a generation later, writing his own sonnet, Le Cygne, undoubtedly with Baudelaire's in mind. And then, jumping over several transitions, we get The Wild Swans at Cool, W.B. Yeats. That's the title of this poem, of this collection we now come to. And this is the first of several swan poems by Yeats, which we shall come to later. I look forward briefly to one. One is called Cool Park and Ballylee, 1931. I mention that because that is one which is most closely related to particularly the Mallarmé. So that the French Saint-Maurice tradition did have its tenuous but very real influence upon Yeats throughout his life. The Blakean influence was much stronger, much more powerful, if only because Yeats's French was in fact quite imperfect. And anyway, we're now with a vision, we see Yeats at his most Blakean, his most like William Blake. And those who have been turned on by Ann Mellor's lectures on Blake, for instance, ought now to find themselves getting really very happy. Is a very Blakean poet that we now come to with a vision. Thus you see, the sort of things that I've very briefly introduced you to will be fleshed out a little for you in, not so much in Saul's Prolegomena, but in Graham Martin's essay, and particularly in Camoens' book, Romantic Image, which is very much a rethinking, indeed, of the French Symbolist influence upon modern English and also American. Now, the time that remains, as promised, let us talk about the autobiography. And I did ask that there be specific passages in your minds that you want to talk about. Yes?
He uses the phrase, the vision of evil, in several places in The Trembling of the Veil, always capitalized, and I'm not quite sure what he means by that. Why he capitalized.
Yeah. Do you have a particular pen?
Part of 83, he uses it in connection with talking about suffering. At the bottom there, about Dante.
Yeah. Had not Dante and Villon understood that their fate wrecked what life could not rebuild, had they lacked their vision of evil, had they cherished any species of optimism, they could but have found a false beauty, or some momentary instinctive beauty, and suffered no change at all, or but changed as do the wild creatures, or from devil well to devil sick, and so round the clock. Perhaps we ought to take that up earlier. He's talking, in fact, here about Dante, to begin with.
paragraph is very, very, very... He's talking here in a way which is, for some temperaments, not very helpful. This is from that passage, Hodos Chameleontos, which is in many ways the most difficult and, of the autobiographies. He's talking about personifying spirits. He says, and this is the top of page 183, that we had best call but gates and gatekeepers, because through their dramatic power they bring our souls to crisis, to mask and image. We have dreamed a foolish dream these many centuries in thinking that they value a life of contemplation, for they scorn that more than any possible life, and let it be but a name for the worst crisis of all. They have but one purpose, to bring their chosen man to the greatest obstacle he may confront without despair. They contrive Dante's banishment and snatched away his Beatrice, and thrust Vio into the arms of harlots and sent him to gather cronies at the foot of the gallows. That Dante and Vio might through passion become conjoined to their buried selves, turn all to mask and image, and so be phantoms in their own eyes. In greater, lesser writers like Landor and like Keats, we are shown that image and that mask as something set apart. But in a few in whom we recognize supreme masters of tragedy, the whole contest is brought into the circle of their beauty. Such masters, Villon or Dante, let us say, would not, when they speak through their art, change their luck. We gaze at such men in awe because we gaze not at a work of art, but at the recreation of the man through that art, the birth of a new species of man, and it may even seem that the hairs of our hands stand up, because that birth, that recreation is from terror. Had not Dante and Vio understood that their fate wrecked what life could not rebuild, had they lacked their vision of evil, had they cherished any species of optimism, they could but have found a false beauty, etc. This is a very important passage. It's a good thing you sent us to it, Mr. Sherman. There are other passages like it.
He is here distinguishing what he takes to be the really great masters, supreme poets. An example from late medieval France, François Villon, and the other example, almost inevitably, from medieval Italy, Dante Alighieri. And discriminating them from two poets whom he still values very, very greatly. Very great poets, but not supreme masters, Landor and Keats. And he says the difference is that Dante and Villon are tragic poets, not just in the sense that they write things called tragedies, but that the whole shape of their lives was tragic, and that the shape of their lives gets reflected in their art, so the art and the life are one. And this is not the same in Landor or in Keats. We might quite justly say, the tragically short life of Keats, in dying from consumption at such an early age, is a disaster, and we feel waste. We feel, what pointless waste of that great talent to be snuffed out like this. We do not feel like that about the fact that Villon is hanged on the gallows as the end of our criminal life among the stews and brothels of Paris. We do not feel that about the fact that Dante dies in agonized banishment from his native Florence. Because what we value in the poems which Dante and Villon write is the immediate result of the sufferings which they underwent. One might even say, it's not quite what Yeats does say here, though he comes near to saying it in other places, they actually seek out those sufferings. And there certainly have been poets who have taken that step. And Baudelaire is perhaps the greatest, one of the most striking examples of that in modern times, relatively modern times. Baudelaire, who said, j'ai cultivé mon hystérie. My sickness, moral and psychological, is in fact the most precious thing I have to make my art out of. I have cultivated it. I have deliberately exacerbated it in order to write Flowers of Evil, the poems that come out of it. And Yeats is saying that these are the most astonishing prodigies that we experience. Incidentally, this, I'm sure, is part of the extraordinary
life that I hope you will have realized is beating in the pages which Yeats gives to Oscar Wilde at the beginning of The Trembling of the Veil. Wilde is not quite an example of this sort because his art is not good enough, and Yeats knows it. But the fact that Wilde certainly does deliberately court and live out a representative tragedy for his generation makes him, in that respect and to that degree, like a Dante or a Villon. And there are others of whom one could feel the same. Yeats did not live to see it, but what we were talking about the other day, Pounds pushing his right-wing fascism, or his right-wing anti-democratic sentiments to the point at which he is in fact actually found on the wrong side in a war and being arraigned for treason and having and escaping the death sentence, I suppose, by dint of being diagnosed, rightly enough, as of unsound mind and then incarcerated at the behest of his government for 12 years in a hospital for the criminally insane. That too, if Yeats had lived to see it, I think he would have regarded as a poet who actually acting out in his own life the representative tragedy. After all, Yeats and Eliot and D.H. Lawrence and Percy Wyndham Lewis and many others were having the same right-wing enthusiasms and leanings in the 1930s, yet Pound was the man who was rash enough, impulsive enough, foolish enough, that's the sort of person he was, actually to push it all the way and get copped for it. And so he, in a sense, representatively acts out the tragedy of his generation. This, therefore, is what the vision of evil means. That is to say that there are certain forces abroad in the world at any time, in any generation, that is to say, they take different forms in different generations, which certain forces which are actively concerned to cripple, stifle, and silence the creative imagination. And another, an interesting point here is Yeats does bring this up at a late point when he is talking about, indeed about Emerson and Whitman. Someone was asking me about this after class. Did Yeats read these? Did Yeats read American literature? Yes, he did. And he read it with sympathy and with some care. But he says in the end that now Emerson and Whitman cannot be the great poets because they lack a vision of evil. And of course, they do. The Emersonian universe and the Whitmanesque universe is ultimately sanguine. It is open-ended. It is there is no reason why, if not in this generation or in this lifetime, in another generation or another lifetime, the human individual and his universe shall not come into total harmony. There is no sense of an ultimate disjunction in the nature of things between the human mind in its creative and imaginative needs and the universe which it has to inhabit. Hence, tragedy depends upon the recognition of that disjunction and the acting of it out. Right, well, we'll meet again on Friday.
Well, after you left, let's see, so that was in 2 years, I guess.
2 years.
2 years in. No, it was, yes, it was 2 years in March, the 72.
And then the...
That was a short time after he left, and I couldn't, anyway, then. I'm sorry that I went that soon. I wish I'd waited till later.
And the two Friday clinics were roughly when?
Well, one was while he was still home, and he knew I was trying.
3 years ago.
Yeah.